This is Pamela Banos, and I'm speaking with Dawn Cobb, who we were just discussing her title of being either physical anthropologist or, what was the other one?
Bioarchaeologist.
So can you explain to me exactly what your job is?
Well, bioarchaeology is kind of the study of archaeology through the skeleton. Archaeologists have subspecialties. Some are into lithics and projectile points. Other people are into ceramics. But it takes a real special interest to be involved with the skeleton. I mean, you have to really, really love the skeleton to want to go that route instead of just straight archaeology.
So what was your route to end up in this position school-wise?
Archaeology initially, and then went to graduate school and hooked up with a professor who was studying a human skeletal population, and that's where it all clicked.
So your encounters with skeletons, do they mostly have to do with accidental finds, like the way we're finding cemeteries, and in particular how my project is dealing with this surprise in Chicago?
Sometimes you actually have a planned undertaking, which is just a fancy way of saying there's a project and you know there's a cemetery involved, so you have to deal with the cemetery before you go in, or at least have a plan about how you're going to proceed. A lot of times they are accidental. The river washes them out, or a water main goes through, and you're digging a trench and there's someone in it. So
in terms of the Lincoln Park case, you explained to me that there were three stages, and the trench, I guess, would have been the first stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so go over those three steps for me again.
Okay. The phase one archaeological survey is step one, and that's where if you have a project like the expansion of the garage or building of the garage, and if the officials suspect that there might be an archaeological site nearby or even a cemetery in that case, they would have to hire an archaeology firm to go out and do a phase one survey. So but there's still state and federal regulations that mandate having to do this. So what the archaeologist would do would go out and look over the ground. It might actually dig some shovel tests, which is digging a shovel full of earth up, screening it, looking for different artifacts. They would also go through this process and look at the historic documents, especially in this case if they had suspected a cemetery was there. They would go, should have gone and looked for the historic documents. People are typically buried 6 feet below the ground. That just become the standard. And a lot of these structures don't go that deep. Some of the initial footings, obviously, for the garage would have and the building would have, and that's probably why they found them. But there are houses out there today that are built over remains that you just don't know were there.
Yeah, they're just on the south side of North Avenue.
Yeah.
Where the Catholic cemetery was.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. Okay, so the first step is you accidentally find something,
mm-hmm.
and the second step is you call in the authorities,
mm-hmm.
who would be, in this case,
the county coroner. Or in Chicago's case, it'd be the medical examiner. And they would make a determination of whether or not the remains were modern. And modern, we have a cutoff date of 100 years. So if it's within 100 years, the coroner has jurisdiction over the remains. And if it's over 100 years, the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency has jurisdiction.
So who determines how old?
The coroner does. And a lot of times, they'll have someone on staff, or they might have people that they can call in and say, what do you think about this? But they've had so much practice. A lot of times, with embalming and things, you know, that can muddy up the waters, because someone who's embalmed could have been embalmed in 1870, but the likelihood of those remains actually existing beyond a skeleton is really rare, unless you have an iron casket. But so what they would do was they would call the authorities, and the coroner would come out and make a site visit and determine, this looks archaeological, this does not look like a modern crime scene, and it looks like it's over 100 years. And basically you kind of look at the context of the remains. What kind of burial feature was it in? Did you find coffins? Are they square? Are they round? Is there any kind of coffin material left? You can kind of judge from the context of the burial how old it might be. So if the coroner decides he does not have jurisdiction, then the state has jurisdiction, which is the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency. And we administer a law called the Human Skeletal Remains Protection Act, which literally will protect all unregistered graves grave markers and grave artifacts. And grave artifacts means anything in the contents of a grave, handles, nails, personal items. But the remains have to be over 100 years old and not in a cemetery registered with the comptroller's office. If it's registered with the comptroller's office, technically they have jurisdiction. And then they have, that's another tangent, if you will.
Even if the remains are more than 100 years old?
If the remains are more than 100 years old, but it's registered, there's a little bit of a gray area. And I think we would probably work together between agencies to figure out a solution. The ultimate solution from our point of view is preservation in place. And we really try and work with individuals and contractors and developers to guide them down that path. But if it doesn't go that way, then the remains or cemetery can and sometimes have to be moved, but they have to hire professional archaeologists and skeletal people to do this. It's not enough to have a funeral director come in. They do the work, and they do work with dead bodies all the time, and we're very respectful of that profession. But if I was moving somebody, I'd want to make sure I got all the pieces of that individual moved. And we want to make sure that individual stays together with their grave marker, if it's present, or with their artifacts. There have been cases when the funeral director's been called in, they just bring in a backhoe, make a big scoop, put it in a body bag, and rebury it. That's not good enough. You want to make sure that there's that person there, mm-hmm. all of that person, and if there's more than one person, separate them out.
And so then in what form do you receive them here?
Typically in boxes or plastic bags.
And how much volume would that, how much space would an individual, or does it matter, or does it depend on the...
It depends on the circumstance. Sometimes you get an entire skeleton, but in most cases they're not perfectly preserved all the way, so you get parts of people. And in old cemeteries, sometimes when you're digging a new grave, you accidentally hit an old grave because it's unmarked. A lot of times those bones were gathered back up and put at the foot of this person and just reburied in that same shaft, which is close to where they came from and originally. And that's part of what's happened here at the Lincoln Park Cemetery is you have what we call primary interments or primary burials, but then you have some commingled remains, which are extra pieces from someone else. And those were always tucked, they seem to be tucked at one end or the other of a grave, or they were obviously discovered when the analysis was
what
completed.
Would that imply if they would find an entire set and then commingled with a...
That probably means they hit it under a pre-existing grave and just didn't know it because it wasn't marked.
As they're researching and finding one grave, they found another that wasn't marked? That's curious.
No, I mean when someone wants to bury person A, the primary person, and they hit a pre-existing grave, they would gather up those bones and
move them
off to the side and rebury them in the same pit.
So the second stage is that the once the coroner signs off, the state becomes involved, the archaeologist becomes involved, and then this third stage?
Third stage is working with our agency and the developers to determine the best course of action. And if the choice is made that the remains have to be moved, that's when they have to hire the full archaeological team and the osteologist to come in and do the work. Those skilled professionals have to be on site during the entire process. So they would literally strip off the topsoil with a backhoe or a track hoe because it's just expedient. And what it does is uncovers the grave stain, and then at that point...
you see, like, effectively the footprint?
You see the footprint. It's a rectangular stain, and most times with infants and children, it's smaller and may not be exactly rectangular, but they're very distinct in what they are, their size. They typically line up in rows. They might even be in groups with space in between, you know, demarcating family plots or something. Mm-hmm. And then what the archaeologists would do would be to... stop use of the heavy equipment. They start using shovels and trowels. And as soon as you start seeing coffin nails, you're very close to the lid. Then you start using brushes. You still use some trowels to a point, but when you start getting close to the skeleton, and it's obvious when you come down on a skeleton. I mean, the bones start showing through the dirt, and you start getting more nails. You might find handles or whatever was buried with that person. You start using picks and... brushes, just less invasive tools, We really try and limit the use of metal tools because it can damage. So we really wanted to really preserve the person, uncover them totally, document where they are with photographs and maps. And we have what they do is they prepare a huge site plan map where you have your whole project area defined on a piece of paper, say 18 by 24. Within that point, you have the cemetery literally marked out with its boundaries, and each individual grave is mapped onto that map or drawn onto that map. So you know exactly who was where and what. And then you would have an individual map for each burial feature that would show the coffin outline, it would show the skeleton and any kind of artifacts it would have with them.
How long would that process take typically?
It can take a long time, only because it really honestly depends on the size of the burials, the cemetery. Somebody that had 5 or 6 grave features to excavate can be done inside of a week with the excavation portion. If you have something like the Lincoln Park Cemetery, that took several months.
And so I'm looking at the list here that looks like it's a description. Each set of remains has an inventory number, the ascension date, the site where it was found, burial, which they all say none. What does that mean?
That means a burial feature was not assigned. In the case of the Lincoln Park Cemetery, they didn't assign specific burial numbers. They just assigned feature numbers. Sometimes archaeologists use burial numbers, sometimes they use feature number.
Okay. And then it says other?
Other provenience. That's where if we have any additional information, for example, if you have a grave, say grave one had 2 individuals in it, then you would put individual one in the other provenience, and individual two would get its own record.
Okay. And then the next column says components of skull?
Skeleton.
Oh, SK, and then SK. It cuts off. So it says cranial and postcranial as the 2 options.
Well, we actually have 5. We have cranial, we have cranial, postcranial, we have postcranial only, we have cranial, and we have complete. And what we're doing is we're following a set of standards documenting how much of the skeleton is present. So if you have 75% of the skeleton present, we consider it complete.
Okay, and so postcranial would mean?
Arms, legs, ribs, vertebra. Cranial is just the cranium of the skull itself. And everything post or below is postcranial.
Understandable. So then that means that this was missing a skull?
Yes. It could have been half of the individual was there.
Why? How would you account for that?
One is preservation. If the soil is poor, especially if it's acidic and there's a lot of water percolating through the area, the bone tends to degrade a lot faster and only parts will be preserved. And a lot of times the leg bones are preserved because they're nice and they're thick. They're weight-bearing, so they need to be a thicker bone.
Right. I would think the skull would be thick and pretty.
It is, but the skull is pretty fragile. I mean, it's a hollow ball, if you will, and granted, the empty cavities in a body do fill up with dirt, but the bones are thin. And you'd think as important as our brain is to our bodies,
it would be protected better.
But it's not.
So cranial then would imply that only a head was
or found. Part of a head. If you have a set of teeth, that's cranial.
And so if you don't find where the set of teeth go, you assume that that is an entirely separate being.
Yes.
Okay. The next column you have here is age at death. It's separating adult, middle adult, young adult, child. And so you look by the size of the bones.
That's part of the osteology analysis process. What if you have a juvenile, which we consider less than 20 years of age because they're not physiologically developed as a rule, what you can look at for infants and children, you look at how developed their teeth are, how erupted they are through their mouths. You can, if you have whole bones, you can take long bone lengths, compare them to known anatomical charts to get an age estimate. For adults, you look at the degree that their skeleton is fused. Especially with adolescents and kids, long bones, for example, are made up of 3 primary parts. The joints are separate pieces until you reach puberty, and that's when your growth hormones really kick in and your sex hormones kick in, and your body just starts going through all the changes. And we see it outwardly, but inwardly what's happening is your skeleton is starting to fuse together to become the full adult skeleton. The last bone to fuse is your clavicle or your collarbone. So we know that if the rest of the skeleton is fused but that collarbone is still unfused, they're typically under 30 years of age. And once you stop developing, then it becomes literally a reversal process. Your body starts breaking down. It's just you wear and tear. Once you develop, you're done, then you start wearing and tearing. And then that's when we look at the arthritic changes in the body, or we look at how worn the teeth are, and that gives us a sense of how old the person is.
Okay, so the last column here is sex or gender, and that would follow that sometimes you know quite clearly and sometimes you don't, which is why they're designated unknown sometimes here. So why would your staff, or you said students actually, studied these to categorize them this way?
Correct.
Why is it important or necessary to go through this type of feature detailing for record keeping?
It's really important because if you can establish an individual identity based on someone's physical characteristics, you can compare some of the things with historic documents, and those even include family letters. And if someone comes through in 150 years and says, my great-granny was buried here, or my great-grandpa was, he lost his arm in the Civil War, or whatever, you can look through your records and find an adult male of approximately the same age missing an arm. There's obviously, if it's been a medical amputation, the bone heals itself. It's been, you know.
So these, I'm honing in here because I have a lot of information on people and possibly from this area. I haven't got it sorted out quite well enough to really know where anybody would be.
Right.
And also the lot numbers that I have. Mm-hmm. At this time, in the location where they were digging, it was the old survey. It was the oldest part of the cemetery.
Okay.
And the lots were sold by 9 by 24 feet.
Really?
Yeah. And then later they changed to 9 by 12 feet.
Okay.
And so a 9 by 24 foot lot would contain 8 bodies if it was full.
Sure.
So I'm assuming 9 would be the, you know, from head to toe, and then however many across. So 3, 6, 9, 12. You could get 4 people in a 9 by 12 lot.
Right.
And so each of the lots that I'm looking at that I have the information from could feasibly contain up to 6 sets of remains.
True.
And I don't know, I have a pretty extensive list, but I don't know where it's all plotted out at this point.
Right.
But just to extrapolate, if I were to have finally been able to build this map by the survey, and if I have a family name, theoretically, if a member of that family comes back now 4 generations later, can they claim that set of remains?
Yes. But they have to prove through genealogical records that that person was their ancestor, and they're a direct lineal descendant of that. I mean, our law is very clear about that. We don't just return remains willy-nilly to just anyone who has a claim. They have to prove the records. But we're not going to know if that person in that plot was truly the individual they're looking for because there is no marker.
So the marker has that much importance.
Oh my gosh, the marker is so critical because you have the name, date of death, wife or husband of, daughter or son of. There's a lot of genealogy on markers, and they're very critical. If you have an unregistered grave, if you have an unmarked grave that has no identifying characteristics other than the individual in the plot and some basic artifacts, there's no way you can identify them. You can consider DNA analysis. DNA analysis gives you pretty low returns. And at this point, I've been talking with some researchers from Arizona who have tried to do the ancient DNA studies and kind of have gotten away from it just because of the low return. It can give you a general area. She learned she was from, you know, northwestern Germany.
Okay.
Right. I mean, it cannot give you the Smith family. It cannot give you this family versus this family versus this family. I mean, it's a good technique. But in terms of identifying individuals, it's going to be harder. Now, there is a process of extrapolating mitochondrial DNA because it actually gives you a more detailed blueprint of your individual genes in it, but it only passes from the mother's line. So if you have a male skull, you're going to have to find one of your mother's relatives, like a brother or whatever, to compare it with. And we did have a case where some remains were found and someone suspected that they were his father's, and they did some DNA testing, got blood from his uncle, and found out that it was the same person, and those remains were returned and buried.
So they did all that work to get this set of remains that had been forgotten.
Well, yeah. They were discovered in a ditch along the side of the road. They were very close to a VA hospital, and the father had gone missing several years before then. And the son, I mean, they sat in our collections area for a number of years, and the son just kept, I think it was actually a newspaper reporter that remembered the story and started following leads up and said, well, what about this? And the son contacted us and said, would you consider having it tested for DNA? So the FBI was involved, they got their testing, and that's how, you know, that's kind of the process of elimination that way. It's really rare, because with these older cemeteries, you just don't know. And families move, families die off, families forget. So it's left to the general public to pick it up.
So the Chicago City Cemetery was still, at least this part, was still in existence. They were trying to find, they knew they wanted to make it into a park, even at the time of the Chicago fire, But so what happened was that in 1871, the Great Chicago Fire blew through, and that was the northern edge of the fire area.
Okay.
And it stopped at the park because of the park, essentially. It
fire
sort of
break.
Died down, and the trees and whatever. And so it sort of swooped along the lake and that. So I've been reading these narrative accounts of the fire, and oftentimes, and it's, they seem almost more legendary than truthful a lot of the times now, where they talk about the open graves, that people were hiding in the open graves to dodge the fire and all of that. So, I mean, that's sort of an aside. It's believable in the extent that they were disinterring at that time.
Right.
Kind of randomly, and it wasn't a massive kind of exodus. There was none at that time. But the other interesting feature of the grounds that I'd read about as part of these narratives is that the fire charred and broke headstones. And as a result of that, what it did was it expedited the cleaning up of the grounds. And the city was doing their due diligence in terms of trying to get people to remove their families, that finally it was sort of in shambles. And as the city was reconstructing, they essentially cleared the grounds at a certain point.
Yeah.
So they removed the markers.
Right.
I came across a reference in the Lincoln Park Commissioner minutes that said that all of the stones, all of the lots that still have stones, they will be disinterring those bodies and removing them to this 1 acre ground just a little bit further north.
Right.
And so because they had the markers, they knew where to dig.
Right.
So they got those markers, they dug up those remains, and they moved them essentially 500 feet north and reinterred them all in a 1 little acre plot.
Okay.
But that's only because they knew there was someone there because of the markers, which is what you're saying. And so markers get lost.
Markers get lost.
Families go. And then...
And unfortunately, vandalism plays a big part in damaging the markers. Once you have a break, it continues to erode. I mean, marble, it's a soft stone. And even some of the early stones might have been wooden or even sandstone.
Right.
Those are even softer.
Right.
So... I'm not surprised. And a lot of times, and I'm speaking from personal experience, when someone has said, oh, the record said that cemetery was moved, and I look at them and say, so why are you finding bodies now? Not everybody got a stone, or the family didn't have enough money, or it was just a wooden cross. The locations get lost. Even though the bodies are still there, the location's lost. And oftentimes, people were paid to move a cemetery. They may have moved a few bodies, and it became easier just to move the stones, take them away, and look, the cemetery's moved, go ahead. And that happened.
So, let's talk about the iron coffins.
Okay.
So you didn't know anything about an iron coffin.
No.
I asked David Keene, and he said, yes, in fact, they found an iron coffin, but inside the iron coffin was an embalmed body, is how he said it.
Okay.
And so he contacted the Department of Health, and nobody wanted anything to do with this.
So understandable.
So they reburied it in another cemetery. And I haven't yet spoke with him specifically about what that means, but I would love to have seen that iron coffin.
Me too. I've only seen two.
And so for the reason being that the body was embalmed, is it because it was sealed and so the body was in a state that wasn't decomposed, you know, to the degree of skeletal remains, and so they were kind of freaked out?
And the chemicals they used were a lot more harsh, not that they're not harsh now, but they were like arsenic in those times.
And chemicals for embalming?
For embalming. They used arsenic typically. And when you go to the Museum of Funeral Customs, they will tell you this and you'll see it. But it may have been a health issue. I mean, when you have soft tissue and it hasn't hit air until you open up that coffin, or if the coffin got broken during the excavation or during the discovery, then the air is going to seep in and the person's going to start disintegrating literally before your eyes. And that still presents a health hazard because you don't know what they died from or how well the embalming process was.
So that's interesting because Russell Lewis mentioned that, and I haven't spoken with him yet, but I will, that somebody said the word cholera, which got everybody all in a tizzy. And perhaps following up with what you just said, that does make a sort of sense.
It does. And that's some of the concerns we have when we're working with historic cemeteries and find out that different individuals have died of cholera, and you just have to look at the ground and wear masks, wear gloves.
So that bacteria would still be active?
It could. But cholera was such a fast-acting disease. It hit you, you died. But it was transmittable. And other diseases were in existence then that were airborne. All you had to do was breathe on somebody. It was influenza was bad, and there were just other nasty things out there. So we're always cautioned by health departments when we talk to them and say, this is the process we're going to be involved with. This is the type of cemetery. This is what's going on. What should we be aware of? And some of those things come up. But it's a risk. Sure, it's a risk. But
so it does make sense that they wouldn't want to open it. But is it fairly common then to reinter it somewhere else? I mean, I'll find out more when I get there.
That's really unusual because of the cases that I've worked on and have heard about in my office, you rarely find anybody with soft tissue. And if it's soft tissue, you have hair or something preserved. And then those are actually preserved in the freezer, so they
remain.
Yeah. But in terms of the soft tissue, and then being reburied like that, I'm sure they probably had permission from the health department, obviously, but I wonder if they must have notified our office at that point because they're working under a burial permit to do this. But the person's unidentified, so it's kind of a catch-22. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you do?
So if they had a family member, they would have been able to...
If they could identify him.
Pick it up. Yeah, but then they would have to open it.
Yeah, yeah. So
another catch-22.
It's one of those, there's the right thing, there's the law, do they coincide? That will definitely be something I'd like to look into and see what happened, yeah.
So it's pretty much the case that coffins are gone after 100 years, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, the wooden coffins, a lot of them were built for expediency. Some of them are very elaborate, and they were painted or varnished, made out of nice woods like walnut. But it really honestly depends on the soil that the individual's buried in. If you're buried in a sandy soil, you get a lot of water percolating through, or gravelly soil. You might get bits and pieces of the wood, but it's usually attached to a handle. There's the handle, the salts in the middle tend to preserve the wood. They also preserve fabric. But again, you don't know you kind of have to infer what someone's wearing by the artifacts you find with them. And artifacts, I mean like clothing fasteners or
jewelry,
jewelry, which is rare.
Okay, so let me ask you definitively to tell me how many sets of remains in however many pieces or parts they came up were disinterred from the Lincoln Park Cemetery?
I have 81.
Well, thank you, Dawn, so much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.